Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
An affluent daughter of privilege, a glamorous manipulative wannabe, a determined reporter in too deep, a grieving widow who has to choose her new reality. Just some of the ingredients that are actually featured in the latest awesome novel by that tremendous best-selling author and indeed multiple Emmy-winning reporter, Hank Phillippe Ryan. Hank, it's good to have you back on the program again. Good to see you, actually, because previously we've just actually done phoners, and here you are in person, so to speak.
In person, on Zoom, and it is the way of life right now. Thank goodness we have it, right? What would we do without it?
It's become a whole new world. If only we had shares in the company at the start of the year, we would have been fine. But never mind. We'll work our way through that. Now, as somebody who was voted, I believe, according to your latest TED talk, as a person who was most interesting, the most interesting person from your yearbook back in the day, to becoming the awesome, fantastic author that you actually are, I love the line, and again, referring to your TED talk, which said, "I don't like surprises." I thought, well, that's fine. We'll work our way through that. We'll keep it to the end. But I did think the lovely tale about how you don't mind spoilers if they actually you take away from the surprise, really.
Well, so many things to unpack in that. And let me start with saying, yes, when I was 14, I was voted not most interesting, which is your wonderful take on what they must have meant.
Of course.
But actually, I was voted most individual, which actually meant most misfit and most unlike the rest of us. I know, right now, most individual sounds lovely. It sounds like you're unique and forward thinking.
It's synonymous with interesting, you see, you know?
It is, but not when you're 14, not when you're a geeky, nerdy little 14-year-old girl named Harriet, as I was, and all the cool girls were Debbie and Linda. Most individual was not what you want. But that was actually a life-changing moment for me. It really made me realize not only that I wanted to spend my life doing something that would change the world and leave a mark and leave a legacy, but then also I sort of needed to stand up for myself. That it was one of those things where I would say, watch what I'm going to do now, all of you who didn't invite me to the prom, you know, that kind of thing. So it was a life-changing moment. We don't know when those are going to happen. You know, and so I embraced that. They put my picture in the school paper upside down. That's to show how weird I was. That's, you can take what you will from that.
I'm shaking my head, dear listener, because I'm just shocked, deeply, deeply shocked. However, I will quote from one of, I think, your favorite authors that you featured at the start of Truth Be Told, the wonderful Jane Austen. Seldom, very seldom, does complete truth belong to any human disclosure. Seldom can it happen that something is not a little disguised or a little mistaken. And that's really weaving the ingredients into the perfect crime writer, surely. I mean, that whole notion of mystery, the masks that people wear, the ways in which we kind of, I mean, as the title of your latest text says, the first to lie. Is it a little lie? Is it a white lie? Is it a big lie? Is it a Donald Trump lie? Oh, sorry, I said I wasn't going to get political. Where are we going with the whole lie situation?
Well, it's so fascinating because as a crime fiction author and as an investigative reporter, I've been a reporter for 43 years on television here in Boston. As a television reporter, what I'm looking for is truth and justice, and that the world should work the way the world should work, which it so seldom does. But how do we get to truth? How do we get to justice? And what does truth mean? And those are big philosophical and important questions. I mean, I write crime fiction. I write fast-paced, page-turning thrillers. I want you to miss your stop on the bus. Remember the bus? Because
socially distanced, Hank. Socially distanced.
Okay, exactly. Because you just can't put the books down. But underneath, you know, I think a book is only valuable if underneath the fast-paced, compelling plot is a thought-provoking, is something thought-provoking, the current of, you know, if you tell a good story and I tell a good story about the same event, they're going to be different. And how do we decide what to believe? And how do we decide who to believe? And that's what I'm going for in these stories. Now, I've been an investigative reporter, as I said, for a long time, and I've gone undercover and in disguise to get my stories so often. And that is what has really informed this book, because I thought, you know, going undercover, we become someone else, right? I'm pretending, I'm lying with every bit of my soul. I'm pretending that I'm someone else. So is that okay in the service of a greater good to find out a secret, something but that someone is hiding who doesn't want you to know it? Mm-hmm. And the only way for me to discover that as an investigative reporter is to pretend I'm someone else. And I started thinking so many things about that, but one of them was, what if someone decided that the undercover persona that they were being was more valuable to them, more desirable to them? What if being someone else could get you what you wanted? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so, I think that is so fascinating, because, you know, the way I talk to you is different than the way I talk to a stranger. You know, the way one talks to as a family member is different than the way one talks to one's boss. I mean, we all pretend to be someone else, and we all act. We're all acting all the time. But when someone is acting in a gaslighting, deceptive, manipulative way, that psychology that we can all use on each other, what if we could convince someone that we were someone else? And what if we, in doing that, we could get what we wanted for better, which sometimes works in investigative reporting, for instance, or for worse, when someone's out for revenge, or if someone is obsessed with having something happen, like in The First to Lie. In The First to Lie, it's all about obsession and revenge. I mean, somebody was saying to me once, can you describe The First to Lie in 4 words only? And I said, I can.
It's The First to Lie. There are the 4 words. The First to Lie. End of.
You're way ahead of me, as always. But I would say betrayal, motherhood, obsession, and revenge. And in those 4 words, you have the essence of The First to Lie. How far would you go to get what you want? And what if that was good for you, but terrible for someone else? So The First to Lie is two smart women facing off in a high stakes psychological cat and mouse game to get revenge for a devastating childhood betrayal. But which woman is the cat? And which woman is the mouse? And which woman will be the first to lie? And that's what The First to Lie is all about. It was such fun to write.
I'm struck actually by the philosophical aspects there, because I can almost imagine Immanuel Kant and indeed John Stuart Mill actually looking down from either a utilitarian principle or the whole notion of truth and the importance of truth. And what you raised there, which is, if it's for the greater good, is it acceptable? Is it morally acceptable? Is it ethically acceptable? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I will reveal for the listener, we said multi-awards. I can see many of the Emmys in the background there, which are wonderful. One of my colleagues, Professor Brian Winston, just has the one Emmy. You've obviously beaten him hands down in terms of the Emmys there. But in terms of that whole sequence that we've actually got, it does raise that question. And isn't that actually at the heart of what writing is actually about? Because you're providing an insight into the human condition to begin to explore in a thought experiment way, which after all is what philosophy is pretty much about, thought experiments, the kind of actions that are appropriate, that can work, and so on.
I mean, you're so right, and I'm sitting here nodding, and then I'm realizing we're on the radio and you're not going to see how much I'm agreeing with you. But it's so fascinating, because in writing fiction, we are allowed to talk about the big philosophical picture and the tiny personal picture, which are in essence exactly the same thing. So I focus, for instance, the milieu of The First to Lie is big pharma, but actually it's about the calculus between whether a drug, for instance, that helps many people but harms a few, how do you decide whether that's to be used? And what do you disclose to the patients who crave it? And how much do you tell about what may happen? And how do you let people make their own decisions about what's going to happen in their lives?
I was smiling because I can tell, obviously, the pharmaceutical companies are actually on the phone at the moment saying, please, please don't go on with respect to this. We can't take it anymore.
Yes, of course. I just put them on mute. Yes. It's fascinating to me, though, because what is the ethical and moral necessity that happens when you create a product that can help so many people but may harm others. Mm-hmm. And that's an essential question. And then if you look at that from the standpoint of not only the big picture of the company that's making the decision, but the little picture of each individual person. In this book, in The First to Lie, women who are hoping to be pregnant, women who are hoping to make their dreams come true by finally having a family. And if a company promises them that that will happen and then betrays them purposely for the benefit of other women, how do you deal with that? How does one deal with that? How does the company deal with it? And how does the individual deal with it? So I love the balance between the greater good and the personal good. And I always wonder how we untangle that. And you know, my books are fast-paced vacation book entertaining thrillers. They're not big moral dilemma tomes. But I do think that one of my goals is to have my readers change their lives a little bit, or be, you know, have their interest piqued, or have their thought processes go on a track that maybe they wouldn't have before. Let's look at the world in a different way as a result of reading a book like this. I mean, as an investigative reporter, I have to be new and fast and unique, and I have to break stories, and I have to tell you something that you didn't know before. But I also have to tell a good story. And there's the drug companies again. Exactly. I also have to tell a good story. I'm
fascinated.
Have to be entertaining. And that's the same thing as in my novels.
And ultimately, if you're looking at cultural theory, if we're looking at the way in which populist fiction actually develops, that is the way in which actually ideas begin to develop. Because it's all very well, speaking from my own point of view here, being in an ivory tower academic world where we're doing academic conferences and so on, where we can work through that. But if you can, as you've rightly said, Hank, reach more people from the basis of, well, what if this was the case? I mean, you talked about clearly the essence of the pharmaceutical companies. Next real question is, will you be inspired by the current race for the vaccine for coronavirus that seems to be global, etc., to maybe address some other issues? Because I'm sure that there are possibly, and I might be hypothesizing here, but there are possibly lots of shenanigans going on between major pharmaceutical companies with respect to, again, a search for a vaccine or a cure indeed for coronavirus.
Not a day goes by that I don't think about that. You know, when I was working, you know, the way I do research is for my crime fiction is to sort of just overwhelm myself by taking in information and doing interviews and doing research and looking at documents and searching the law and figuring out how the system is supposed to really work. And then I put that all away when I decide to write the story. And I just write the story as if it's real, as if it's authentic, as if it's a genuinely something happening in the world. But you know, Tess Gerritsen used to say you can always tell when an author's research slip is showing, that they looked up medieval armor, for instance, and they're by golly going to put that in the book because they spent all that time doing that. But I don't want to do that in my book. So I learned all about the pharmaceutical industry. I learned all about how drugs are made and sold and how decisions are made and how doctors are pressured to prescribe them and how they might, what they might receive for that or not, and what is legal and what is not legal. And so and off-label uses and how that can be wonderful, you know, like Latisse and Rogaine and all those kinds of things that turned out to do other things than what they were meant to do. So I think that's fascinating. But when it comes to the truth about it, what is the truth about it? And how do we as human beings, as individuals, decide what true means, decide what safe means? And my goal in The First to Lie, besides being a fast-paced adventure, is to empower people to think about what is at stake here and what is the stakeholder telling me? Why are they telling me what they're telling me? And why is what's true to them might not be true for me? What's good for them might not be good for me. And what is it that's really creating that engine? And so in The First to Lie and in all crime fiction, you know, I think it's right now, it's always safe inside a book. And the reason that we read is that we can for a while become someone else and decide what we would do if we were that person, not us. And that's a way of opening our minds to new worlds and new decision makings and new possibilities, because it's not really us. We can just say, oh, I see what he's really saying, or I see what she's really doing, or don't believe that person. That's not true because X, Y, and Z. And I do think that fiction allows us to expand our own thinking about our own lives, because we can compare what someone in fiction does with what we might have done before and what we might do after having read that book. And that is what I hope The First to Lie can help people do.
I was having a little think when you were sharing the notion about truth. And of course, it's a lovely link in terms of Truth Be Told, another one of your awesome texts, which I particularly enjoyed, which is great for that point of view. But again, the reviews so far have been, as expected, Hank, quite superb. The Publishers Weekly, Stella, you could win a sixth Agatha with respect to this one. And Angie Kim, best-selling author of Miracle Creek, from one of our top thriller writers, a chilling tale of deception and revenge filled with sharp insights. The First to Lie is a house of mirrors, taking us on a thrilling ride of dizzying twists and shocking revelations. I think page turner is the official line we'll actually use with this. Hank, got to ask the question, are the film rights available?
You know, that's in discussion right now. I know you've read The First to Lie, and I know that you've seen how intricate and complex and how interconnected, what a big puzzle it is. And that's so wonderful. You know, my goal is to have people think, when readers tell me, I read The First to Lie and I could just see it, That is my goal, more than having some movie company try to make a movie out of it. Seriously.
Company are on the line now, obviously.
Yeah. But I know, I thought I turned that off. The key of writing a good novel, as far as I'm concerned, is to make a new world that people can actually inhabit, that feels so real that readers will say, oh, I could just picture that. And that means to me that they have made a movie in their mind of the book. That is my goal. You know, Dennis Lehane used to say, when Hollywood would buy his books, he would say, I just take the check and walk away, because you're giving your book to someone who is going to make something else out of it. No longer a book, but a different entertainment form. So if certainly my agent is talking to people who are thinking about this, but it's not something that I really think about all the time. I mean, once a month it might cross my mind, but it's not my goal. My goal is to have the readers be lost in the pages or the sound of the audiobook or the pages of the physical book, and create the movie in their own mind of that. You remember Sue Grafton used to say that she would never allow, and it was in her will, that she would never allow the rights to her Kinsey Malone books to be sold to Hollywood, because they would never get them right. You know, they would never find a Kinsey that everybody would say, oh, that's what she looks like, exactly. And so why disappoint people who love your books by saying, this is how you were supposed to think of it? Mm. You know, I love the idea that we each have our personal feelings about Meg and Ellie and Nora and Gabe. And you will know those characters when you read The First to Lie, and you will have a stake in their decisions and you will care about them. And I made them up for you, but the book is not fully realized until the readers picture those people in their heads. You know, I don't need that to be on video. Readers don't need that to be on video. You know, I'm a television reporter. I love video. I mean, I make my living partly creating little movies of reality. So, you know, I love that, and I endorse that 100%. But sometimes translating a book into a movie doesn't work.
From a literary perspective, of course, the writings of the French theorist Roland Barthes, when he suggested in his text Death of the Author, ultimately, once The First to Lie is in the public domain, effectively, that's it. Every reader will have their own particular interpretation and own particular insight in terms of what's there. Yes, as we've talked about today, there has been an author's intention. You've shared with us, and we've been delighted you've shared with us the sort of lines of that. But just as anybody takes any cultural product at different levels, I'm sure, and I know for a fact, The First to Lie is something else that can be enjoyed on multiple levels, which presumably is good news.
Well, I love that. And that's one of the things that I mean, that's how life is, isn't it? It's multi-layered and multi-leveled, and people have their own feelings about certain things. And then if someone says, but did you know this? But did you think about this? But what about this? And that's like, you know, like tossing a pebble into a pond and watching the ripples spread out. And that's what good crime fiction does, I hope. You know, that's what The First to Lie does, I hope. I lure you into a good story, and then I ask you to think, is that true? Is that true? Is that true? What does this person really want? And what are they doing to their fellow human to get that to happen? And is that fair? And then what about in your real life? The next time you go to the doctor, might you ask a different question than you would have before this book? And if that can happen, that's really great. I mean, that's what I'm going for. And, you know, I'll send in my book to my editor. And for instance, on The First to Lie, she wrote back and quickly and said, oh, I just love this book about motherhood. And I thought, oh, motherhood. Yeah, it's about motherhood. No question about it. She says it's about mother-daughter relationships and familial relationships. And I said, yes, sure. That's exactly what I meant. So exactly as you say, each reader takes what they need from it. And I, you know, that the idea of you know, tens of thousands of readers looking at The First to Lie and having it change their life a little bit in their own personal way, you know, how lovely is that? I mean, I sit here alone in my study, typing and worrying and editing and, you know, deleting and revising. And I love that process. And it's all to see, I'm always searching for the story. I have no idea how my books will end or what will happen next or what happens in the next line or the next paragraph or the next page. I have no idea until I write it, until that new world unfolds for me. So when people say, wow, the end of The First to Lie, you really surprised me. I say, yeah, wasn't that a surprise? I mean, I surprise myself every time. And talk about the human brain, talk about imagination. You know, how can we surprise ourselves? You know, that's incredible to think about. And that is one of the joys of writing.
I believe it was Charles Dickens who actually said his characters actually came to life and spoke to him. And many authors and writers share that, and the sort of you live them, you breathe them, and they develop with that. And that, quite simply, Hank, is one of the reasons why I stand by my original statement. You should have been, if we need to rewrite history, it was indeed most interesting and individual. We'll have a double I for that yearbook entry, you know, interesting and individual from that point. And reset the actual image from the whole thing. That's important. Hank Philippi Ryan, a pronunciation, is it Philippi or Philippi?
Philippi, like the Philippines. Philippi.
And HankPhilippiRyan.com, of course, awesome website, as we've said before. The TEDx talk is wonderful. But as we've said, the new novel is available now, presumably in all good bookstores, or in these days of socially distancing. If you're worried about bookstores, then I suggest you actually should order it online.
Well, you know, the book is available everywhere. It is on every platform, on ebook, on physical book, online, on audiobook, and it's a joy to hear as well. So The First to Lie is easily available. I'm so pleased with it. When the Publishers Weekly Starred Review said stellar, I actually yelped. I was sitting here in my study by myself and I yelped. It is such a stamp of approval after all this hard work and fear and revision to get a pat on the back from people who know what they're talking about, and from you as well. You know, I'm thrilled with your kind words about The First to Lie. Thank you so much.
Well, Hank, it's been a genuine delight, as we always say, when we connect with your good self. It's nice to see you in person, which is always good via the medium of Zoom and so on. Although I appreciate for our listener, it's an audio sort of piece that we're using. We've got two final questions you may recall, but we'll just put them together. They're not surprise ones, so we're okay on that basis. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
This has been a joy. I mean, this is Zoom technology. Who'd have thought we'd ever have to worry about lighting and audio and whether the phone is ringing and whether my husband is slamming the door in the background?
It's noises off, actuality. He's probably looking for an additional sort of credit in the next novel. You know, clearly it's there.
Oh, that's so funny. Now that I'm thinking about it, as Noise Is Off, a play which I adored and laughed all the way through. And how clever was that? Now I'll think about it that way, as an additional.
Exactly. Yes, precisely. It works like that. So could we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you come back and connect with us in the not too distant future?
I'd adore to. Thank you so much. Always a huge pleasure. And I hope your listeners will love The First to Lie.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever. One up and then caress it, touch it, stroke it and undress it. I can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt me. I don't need love, for what good will love do me? Diamonds never lie. Round my little finger, unlike men, the diamonds linger. Men are mere mortals who are not worth going to your grave for. I don't need love.
Alex met me, gosh, it's quite a long time ago now. It's a few years back. I can't remember if we were introduced or whether we just met each other, but I've done a lot of his programs, but never, you know, the Zoom. I've only done one of the Zooms with him.
Well, yep,
it's the second Zoom today for yourself and Phil Herdwood. And that little teaser that we actually had at the start of the piece was just to actually say that we can welcome two fabulous individuals to the programme today. The awesomely talented Queen of Etiquette, Queen of Party Going, founder of the first ever disco in Portugal, amongst other huge things. It's Liz Brewer. Oh, how are you, Liz?
How about that round of applause?
Thank you. Hello, Alex. Wonderful to be here.
Well, likewise. I was going to share with our other fine soul who's online, whose voice we've already heard, the fact that, as far as I recall, it was over a wonderful event in Sloane Square for Galapagos Islands, where we first connected. The Galapagos Islands fundraising charity.
Galapagos Conservation Trust. I put on a mega event with Eric Way, who put on a fashion show. We did fashion shows. We did so much entertainment. But I learned that doing an event like that, it's so much easier to do it in a ready-made venue than in a huge garden, because we did it in the physics garden. And so you have to bring everything in. You have to bring in the catering, you have to bring in the marquees, you have to bring in the sound equipment, and it's not easy. Fortunately, it was an amazing night, I remember. And I remember because I think I had, the dame was either staying at the time, I can't quite remember, but I remember she was in a great state of excitement, as indeed she is at the moment, because she's just bringing out another...
Her I was just going to say, we're referring, of course, to Dame Shirley Bassey, who connected all sorts of ways, but that was the first time we actually met physically. We'd done a few photos before then, and since then, we've never looked back.
No, we haven't.
We appear to have been joined by our number four. I mean,
you're quite right, Philip, because on her way from Teesside to Leeds, having done a piece with me earlier in the show, we're delighted to welcome one of my graduates from the University of Lincoln, and indeed, former, potentially, a member for Parliament, although she was crazily not elected in the last election. It's wonderful, Gemma Joy. How are you, Gemma?
Gemma, how
Hello.
Nice to see
evening,
you.
Evening, everyone. Nice Good to evening. Meet you, everybody. Gemma.
And
we have met over the airwaves actually in the past, I believe. Alexis,
I thought we had.
Yeah, we never actually met in the sort of virtual flesh, as it were, only in the auditory flesh sense. Anyway,
and
you know what I mean.
Philip probably needs no introduction, so I won't give him one, other than being a fine voiceover artist, etc. Probably in need of what Liz is going to be talking about to at least start off this Zoomer, which is etiquette for Zoom meetings and indeed meetings online, etc. So, Liz, you've spoken at length about this on a whole variety of things. We've got Gemma, we've got Philip, we've got myself, etc. Where should we start?
Okay, well, we'll start at the beginning, Alex. So when this happened, mid-March, the first thing that happened is I did this morning, and television for ITV, because they wanted to know how we behave now, how we greet each other, et cetera, et cetera. So I remember doing that. And then shortly afterwards, I got bombarded with, well, okay, so that's how we greet. Now, how do we do virtual meetings? Because that's when they all started. And it was trial and error to begin with. And I do remember being asked to be one of the women to take part into an international women's conference. And I don't know whether you knew this or not, but I was one of about 40 women. Well, in the end, the only one that actually went online, because they had so many problems, was me. And I was supposed to be the second half, but the actual host, the people organizing it, because it was their first time, they didn't know what they were doing. And sadly, the whole thing was a complete waste of time. But I quite enjoyed it. I sort of got into the rhythm of this whole thing about, you know, how we now behave and how the world will reboot and how we're going to have to go forward and how things were sort of balancing off with people. We were no longer judging people by the trainers they were wearing or the handbag they were holding. We were actually beginning to judge people for what they'd achieved in life and what they were doing. And so I actually thought it was a time when we had a lot to learn, and it was good. So this next Zoom meeting that I did, I was doing one with my sister. It was a birthday, which of course is more of a friendly thing. So it's not so much orchestrated, although she did the inviting. So that was something where, yes, everybody could bump, sort of give their piece and interrupt and have a free for all. But with meetings, what you have to do is you have to, apart from having a bit of rehearsal to begin with, to make certain that the sound's okay, that the lighting's okay, that you know what time it is, you've got your water, you've got notepaper, and you then, when you start the meeting, so the host being Alex, he makes certain we all connect, so the host connects, and then we need one person as the host to orchestrate the meeting, to be able to, first of all, you know, break the ice, and we all introduce ourselves. But after that, there needs to be one orchestrator who then sort of leads people in. And then if somebody else wants to say something, they wait till that person has finished speaking, and then they come in and say their piece. But you need one person, as it were, orchestrating it. Mm. if you suddenly feel that, you know, okay, the meeting, so because some meetings go on for hours, but if it's a short one, 30 minutes, or you hope you've been to the bathroom beforehand, but if not, if you can get up from a meeting, excuse yourself, don't make a fuss, and then disappear, and then come back. It's perfectly in order. So the thing about Zoom is that it has been trial and error, but it needs to have some sort of organization. So the host would normally let you know who else is going to be at the meeting, what you're going to talk about, and then it's up to you to do a bit of research to see who the other people are. It's only fair, so that unless you've been given a little bio. So that's the beginning. I'm now going to be quiet, and Alex can ask somebody else.
That's splendid. Splendid, Liz.
Wonderful. I mean, wonderful. Very good. It made me laugh, actually, when you were saying about people giving up and saying apologising. I was on a Zoom to a production manager who was in Iceland, actually, not the supermarket, but he was actually in Iceland.
He was in Iceland,
the country, and he was a very nice man. We were chatting, we were having a very productive meeting, and then he suddenly looked a bit quizzical, a bit alarmed, and he said, oh, hold on a second, and he went and looked out of his window, and he said, wait, somebody's stealing my car. So he left the screen blank. He ran out and he came back in. And he was, somebody's stolen my car. you'll have to excuse me. I'll have to, and off he went. But I thought he got it back, thank goodness. But
that's definitely an emergency. Yeah.
Yes.
So Gemma, if I can turn to you at this stage, because so you were given, I think, about 15 minutes notice of this particular meeting, and you joined us having had another package, which we did earlier in the day. How does that resonate with your own day-to-day work within the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, so we've been using virtual platforms, not as much as this, but for quite a while, because a lot of us are remote, we're field-based, and then there's people in the office, so it's a good way to connect. But it's become more personal, and I think that what Liz has just talked about you're not judging people so much on their handbag or what trainers they're using, that really resonates. And isn't that a lovely thing? Because now we're actually listening to what people have to say, where they're coming from, we're thinking about, I've had so much more productive meetings virtually than I have physically, which is brilliant. I do think there's also something really nice about what we just talked about, not so much having your car stolen, but those everyday occurrences, the dog's barking, the dog wants to come in and look into the camera, a child walks in. You know, these are the things that we all deal with and we juggle our personal life. And I think it's really just a lovely way of connecting with people. So you're dealing with someone professionally or whatever the Zoom's about.
But you it's humanising, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really humanising. Yeah. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, you do have to try and avoid those things happening. We all know there have been a few mishaps that have gone viral, such as some naked going behind. There was a naked woman there was a presenter, and suddenly this naked woman walked behind him in another room. So you have to be careful of your background. Make certain that A, there isn't a door which is going to open and a child comes in, because that's happened before now a few times. Or somebody who's not supposed to be there suddenly walks through, like this poor girl holding all her clothes. So, I mean, there are things like that, and they've gone viral, which people are sort of learning. So you have to be careful of your background, make certain that you haven't got a door that's going to open and shut. There's not going to be people going around that could be disturbing. So these are the kind of things you work out and you think about, as well as the positioning, so that the camera, by now people have got that right, but it's not just showing the under their chin or an ear or something. So it's little things like that which we've sort of learned as we've gone along.
And indeed, Gemma has been so taken aback by the whole thing that we've lost our signal completely. But that's okay. Absolutely. We can cope with that.
We can. No, I think she was right. You know, there's a very much a humanising element to it. And I think I've certainly found, you know, that you can get an awful lot more done, certainly with a Zoom meeting, than you can with, shall we say, an email exchange, which, while it was fast and better than writing letters, you know, or phone calls sometimes, because you're, you know, you can be very precise. Certainly with Zoom meetings, you've got that humanizing element, as well as you can actually put your points over very succinctly, and you can gauge the reactions of the person absolutely, with whom you're meeting. And you can read their body language and their, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yes, and that's really great, you know.
That's a very interesting point, because I'm now being asked, well, and people are discussing, are these virtual meetings going to take over from the normal meetings?
Yes.
Where you actually get, well, I think in some cases, yes, but what we found is, and a lot with some of the meetings that I've had, which have been slightly more serious, they don't replace being together with people. And you mentioned body language, but it's also their energy or eyeball to eyeball, knowing, you know, do you trust what this person's saying or not? It's very difficult to get that over a virtual meeting. And I think that will, talking to quite a few people who are sort of city-based, I think that's the kind of thing that, even though a lot of people don't want to have to go back to the office, I think eventually with that type of meeting, won't replace a virtual one.
I think it might do partially. I was talking, funnily enough, at the weekend to a relation of mine who is actually in the city. He works for a very big news organization. He's the global head of this particular, aspect of this particular company. And he's got people, teams in Asia and teams all around the world that he manages. And he was saying that he spends, and he was based in Canary Wharf, and he can't do that anymore. Obviously, for obvious reasons, because of the coronavirus. But at the same time, he was saying he spends now between 3 and 4 hours a day. He works from home. He spends between 3 and 4 hours a day video conferencing, one way or another. And he said, I will need to go back to the office at some point, and I might do maybe a day a week. I might do half a day a week, just for the one or two meetings that I need to have face to face. Because otherwise, the rest of the time, he's not flying around the world going to all these meetings. So, I mean, I think it will replace an awful lot of meetings. But I think it won't replace all. And I think you're right. I think, you know, there is going to be room for virtual meetings as well as physical meetings.
Question, what's going to happen to all the office space? We are now. I mean, what is happening is quite extraordinary. I don't know if you've been in the centre of London recently, but it's absolutely desolate, because what with the congestion charge of £15 a day, 7 days a week, from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. It means Saturday shopping's finished, people going, you know, to a restaurant or something, wanting to go early to the theatre, etc., and not wanting to go on public transport for whatever reason. It does mean it's definitely suffering dramatically.
Yeah, that was hopelessly misjudged, wasn't it?
Liz, share that pain with Richard Fitzwilliams, who maintains that London still centre still stands to be deserted, but he's still battling through on that. Philip, if I can turn to you, good self, as a voiceover person, you were doing an awful lot of your work from your studio. In any case, in fact, we're looking at your studio now, presumably. So
you are in it. In fact, this is the back end of it you're seeing there, one or two. CDs and so on. And then, you know, my sort of the microphone and the whole, you know, mixing desk and all that sort of stuff is in front of me. So, yes, that's most of the work. It's all, insulated and so on.
And wearing your hat as obviously a film producer and looking to liaise, as you've done with colleagues over in Romania and so on. Again, this is another useful tool to the book, presumably.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, and I'm talking to people because we are putting together a film now with a new executive producer we've got on board. And it's a portmanteau film I won't go into it too much now, but I mean, it's actually there on IMDb, but so it is public, but it's a portmanteau film with stories from 6 different countries in Europe. I have to talk to, you know, Spanish producers. I have to speak to an Irish producer, which I did the other last week, and people from Romania, a production company there, other folks as well. It's absolutely priceless to have that connection. I can do all the phoning I like, but nothing replaces this kind of a situation with a Zoom meeting. I'd be lost without it.
Did we realise when we started those shows back in Dulwich Radio back in the 1980s that this
1980s.
Is Last century, Liz. Last century.
We go back. Really?
We were snotty nosed schoolboys with wearing shorts and blazers, eyes askew.
Speak for yourself, Philip.
Scabby knees.
Were you both at Lincoln University or something?
No
connection there.
I think it's fair to say that it was a mutual friend and colleague, Graham Harper, who suggested that Philip Hurdwood might be a useful guest for the programme. And he's fixated on us like a poodle on a leg ever since. It's fantastic.
I can't leave you. Well, it's an interesting one, but no, I can't leave you alone.
Liz, in terms of, I mean, you addressed some of the netiquette things. I have to say that I did share with some of your colleagues where we left the last Zoomer, which was your suggestion of actually trying out the bum bump. It was greeted. Yes, exactly. It was greeted with scepticism at best, really, in terms of the validity. And they said, no, if we can't do the elbow, we're certainly not doing the bum bump. It's not going to work.
I find I do that a lot, or I do, you know, pat somebody there. But I find it still difficult that, you know, people, they come at you and they know you well, you know, they want to give you a kiss. So,
well, this gets back to Zoom again and how hygienic it is.
Yeah.
it cannot be gainsaid.
Yeah.
Oh, indeed. And if people actually do feel moved to actually kiss the screen, then so be it. So that's what they have to
let
do.
Let them.
Exactly.
People do have their peccadillos, but there we go.
It's true. Yeah. Liz, we started off a few moments ago by talking about, obviously, somebody who's very close to your good self, and I know we featured her at length over the last few years, Dame Shirley Bassey. Another album has been released. It's going to be a classic, no doubt.
Well, yeah, it'll be released later this year, but it was announced. It was embargoed until yesterday. And I was chatting to her the day before, actually. And it's just so lovely to hear the excitement in her life. And she knows what I've been doing these last 5 months. You know, I've been going through all my files, all my clients. And because I did her 60th birthday, her 70th birthday, and her 80th. And before, I mean, if I go back, so that 60, 70, that's 30 years. But I met her 40 years ago. It's a long time. And I said to her, my goodness, I said, honestly, because I call her Dame, I said, honestly, Dame, you wouldn't believe it, that what we got up to and what we got away with and what we did. And it was so glamorous and wonderful and continued to be so. You know, she's such a true star. And there aren't many like that any longer. But she's true, genuine star quality. Yes. But over the years, my goodness, we've had fun all over the world, I might say. We really have. A lot of it I won't be able to write about, but quite a bit I will.
Wonderful to hear, yes.
One thing we can
She is an icon and a national treasure.
Yeah. And I did actually, on my Facebook page, I did actually do the whole sort of announcement bit, and I found so many photographs. And the one I meant to put on, which I'll have to add, was when I did for Cameron McIntosh. It was about, gosh, I don't know, say 20 years ago, Hey Mr. Producer. And I remember it was Cameron put together sort of 10-minute clips of all his musicals. And it was on this occasion, there was a hotel that was opening around the corner. I'm trying to remember what it was called. And anyway, I did the party there beforehand, and we had the Queen coming and the Dame came, and I had Ivana as well then. So I had them both there. And this wonderful picture, so there's the Dame, me, and Ivana, and Cameron. And the picture I've got, I have. But then Richard Young, the Dame, bent down and lifted up Cameron's kilt. And, of course, to see what was underneath. And
as Welsh people are prone to do to Scots, obviously.
And that was like front page of the Times. It went round the world. Yeah. And I just putting all those together now. I've got hundreds and hundreds of files here. You saw my drawing room. But I was sort of reminding you, but I'm going back to that Facebook. I'm going to add that picture on, but not the one of her looking up his
And in case people were wondering, who's Ivana? I think Ivana was married to somebody who became somebody in the United States, I believe. Yes.
Not for much longer, but nonetheless.
I have to tell you, one of the brightest, most intelligent women I've ever met, and certainly ever had as a client. I mean, she's still my client. That's 33 years now. But so smart. Smart cookie, which I think would explain so much of the success in the early years. Because I knew people that dealt with Donald and his various companies then, and they used to deal with Ivana. They're great friends of mine still.
Mm. Well, if she's going to take all the blame, we'd better step away from that now, because it's a different world entirely. Liz, I'm got to ask you to share the tale of when Dame Shirley Bassey actually turned up at one of your daughter's concerts and was basically not believing Dame Shirley Bassey. I think it's a tale you need to share with us.
No, this was Tallulah had finished at university. She'd been at Manchester, and needless to say, even though she got, I think she was reading about 3-4 different subjects, and she did terribly well at uni, but she'd come down and finished, and she came down and she announced, well, you know, I've got a band. I said, you have? Yes, she said, got a band, and we're performing the King's Head at Putney Bridge. I think it was called the King's Head or King's Arms, Putney Bridge, and we've got a gig. Well, I'd never been to a gig, so I rang the dame. I said, Tallulah's performing, we've got to go along. And Tallulah sent me this message saying, Mummy, please dress down. So I thought, okay, and we've got to dress down. So she said, okay, I'll wear jeans. I said, all right, I'll wear jeans. And she said, but then I've got a wonderful tail coat that would go with it. Just so happened I had beautiful sort of women's version of a tail coat. So I said, well, I've got that too. She wore a bustier. I wore a sort of white shirt. So along we went. I also took my lawyer at the time, just in case.
I took
her godfathers, a wonderful late Marquess of Bath, and a few others, and went in to this pub.
Hoping to be unnoticed, of course.
And as we arrived, well, you say that, we arrived, and there's a little kiosk, and the guy stamps you. And he stamps you with a sort of a musical sign. And so I went like that, and he stamped me. And the dame went, I want one there and one there. So he stamped her boobs. And we went in, there were about 8 of us then, and we went in, and there was another band playing. The place was packed, and they finished, so we went to the front, and there was a sort of bonkette there and a bonkette there, no other seating. No other seating. So we went to the right hand side, and there were 3 young guys, and I said, would you mind, but my daughter's coming on next, and we'd like to sit down. And he looked at me and he said, tough. And I said, I don't think you understand. I have Shirley Bassey here and she would like to sit down. And he looked up and he said, pathetic when some old broad has to pretend she's Dame Shirley Bassey. At which point the manager, who must have been either following us or alerted, suddenly appeared and he got the kid by his ear. He dragged him out. So we didn't just sit at the banquette. We actually sat at the back of it because there were so many people we couldn't see. And we put our feet on the sort of rather nasty plastic seat. And Tallulah came on. Well, remember, I hadn't really seen my daughter since she got down from Manchester. She had dreadlocks, blonde dreadlocks. And then the dame said, Liz, isn't that one of your Zandra Rhodes dresses? And Zandra was my client at the time. And I said, not only is it one of my Zandra Rhodes, it's my best Zandra Rhodes, which she was wearing. It's backless and sort of black chiffon and beads. And she'd got a cowboy belt, all hitched up, cowboy boots, this amazing hair. And I mean, I was just speechless. That was the first time I saw Tallulah perform.
Yeah. And was it a good concert? Was it a good gig?
Of course it was a good concert. It's Tallulah Randall, for God's sake.
If you really want to know, Phil, it was fantastic. I had no idea. I kept thinking, that's my daughter. I went home. And the next day, because John Reed was a very good friend of mine, and at that time, I think he was no longer, it was no longer John Reed Enterprises, he was no longer running the life of Elton John, etc. But I rang him and I said, look, I don't know what to do, this is not my business, and I don't know, I've got an EP. So he sent his driver, took the EP, and then about half an hour later, he said, well, are you sitting down? And I said, yes. He said, she's got a great talent, but she's got to do the gigs. And I didn't understand at the time what that really meant. But I have to say, 3 or 4 years later, I did, because you understand, you become more professional. What do you do when the electricity doesn't come on? What do you do if, you know, your drummer doesn't turn up? It's those kind of things, and you learn how to go forward. So it was an amazing experience.
Absolutely. And you learn how to work an audience when it's live. Absolutely. I mean, I maintain 100%. That, you know, I mean, they do say, you know, acting is a weird animal, really, in a way that, you know, I think it's very important to have at least some experience of the stage, because you, it's an organic thing where you know, you're up on the stage, you tell a joke and you get a laugh. You're in a serious scene, which is, shall we say, a weepy, to be, you know, very sort of black and white about it, but and you can sense the feeling from the audience. You can the gasp when they're surprised. So to work, you know, so when you're working in film or television as an actor, you have some sort of a second sense about how the audience is going to respond. And the more experience you have on stage, the more you'll have that second sense. And I think that's important for singers as well as other performers. Oh,
very much so. And I didn't really realise it at the time. I just thought, okay, now let's go make an album, blah, blah, blah. And of course, now, 4 albums later, 4 books later, and doing all her stuff.
And over 30 sort of telephone links with Siren Radio. As you know, we're keen Tallulah Randall supporters. So she's, although yet to do her first Zoom, so we'll put that to rights forthwith.
So what's her name? Sorry, I'm being
Tallulah
brave.
Randall.
Tallulah Randall, her
band is called, is it just her name?
It's or just Tallulah Randall. Look up Tallulah Randall and you will be amazed from it. There we are.
I married her father because I was on my 6th fiancé at the time. And I remember I'd met
only
John.
6, Liz? Surely you were slacking.
I found 2 more. And as it was 6 at the time. And I remember he came along to a meeting. He was in partnership at the time with Roddy Llewellyn. And I met him. And, well, 3 or 4 weeks later, I married him, even though I had at that time Emerald and Diamonds. I had to get rid of Emerald and Diamonds, which had a bit of an overlap with Sapphire and Diamonds and Ruby and Diamonds. But John never gave me, but he'd lived with this famous lion called Christian. And I remember thinking, if he can live with a lion, maybe this is the man for me.
It's
so I did.
It's in the stars, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you afraid? Liz, I must say, you've entertained me enormously. You really have led the most extraordinary life so
and
far.
Continues to do so.
There will be no doubt more. How thrilling. What fun.
I hope so, yeah. As I said to the dame the other day, I said, come on, life hasn't finished yet.
Exactly. Of course not.
That, Liz, is the inspiration that makes us all born free. See what we did there?
That's true.
It's sadly time when we have to say, Liz Brewer, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
I've had a wonderful Zoomer. Yes, absolutely
what
fantastic.
What fun. Well, I'd love to do another Zoomer with you, Liz. It's been such fun.
That would be to listen
to your wonderful stories. I've loved every minute of it.
Well, I should, next time I'll tell you about my brother who makes movies nonstop, but all to do with the great musicians. He's just done Chuck Berry now.
John,
and I'm trying to remember the name, Cardinal Releasing. But he makes all Jimi Hendrix, Nat King Cole, B.B. King. The lot.
Major stars.
It'll happen. But has your brother ever done a music documentary about the McCoys, Liz? This is the question we need to ask. Need to be done. Particularly the go-go dancer in the movie, in the thing there. That's ultimately, you know, what we're looking for.
Every time he brings it up, I change the subject.
Well, there we are.
So. Funny enough, it's funny you should say it, because it was another film producer who contacted me through Facebook. And he said, "Are you? Because I'm making a film with McCoys, and I need," I said, "No, why don't you contact my daughter?" And he said, "Well, are you, aren't you?" I said, "I can't remember. It's too long ago. Can't remember."
The joy of YouTube there. It's there, Liz, for all to enjoy, etc. Lisborough, many thanks indeed. Phil Herdwood, thank you. It's been
a great pleasure. Delight.
And thanks, of course, to Gemma, who's now probably arrived in Leeds, but I think she inserted a lovely sort of question there, which was great.
That was lovely. That was fantastic, her question.
As well.
Wonderful. Lovely. It's been great. Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Oh, we are good.